This ain't your grandma's game show. Or is it?
This is the Extra Hot Great Podcast, episode 357 for the week of May 31st, 2021. I am Tiny IRS Audit David T. Cole, and I'm here with Half-Baked Theory Sarah D. Bunting.
I am not a crockpot.
Nutmeg Nut Tara Ariano.
Go to hell, allspice.
And Bakewell Tart Brittany Luce.
I am extra hot and ready to talk to you guys today.
Welcome to Extra Hot Great for another week. We tried to have her on recently. It did not work out for reasons. She is back. It is writer and podcast host, most recently of The Nod, Brittany Luce. Welcome, Brittany.
Brittany, welcome.
Woo. Thank you so much. I'm so happy to be here with you guys.
Yay! We are thrilled to have you. We, this week, are talking about two junky summer replacement network game shows.
Summertime, it's summertime. This is how we know it's summertime.
Yeah, this is like the hammock week before the actual classy shows start coming back, or at least more respectable, interesting ones. So we're going to be, for now, talking about NBC's Small Fortune and Fox's Crime Scene Kitchen. Let's start with Small Fortune, because based on our last episode, Sarah is going to really want to tee off on Crime Scene Kitchen. I feel like we should end there. So Small Fortune premiered May 31st. It airs Monday nights on NBC. It's a remake of a British format. Lil Rel Howery hosts as a team of three players, attempts to win money by successfully completing mini games on a teeny tiny playing set. And in the first episode, this includes flicking a wee newspaper into a tiny garbage can on a very small model of the Oval Office and sliding gold balls down a chute into a moving train car on a little model train set. So the prize money increases along with the difficulty, but the team doesn't get any of it unless they can pull off a heist at the miniature Lil Rel's Fargo Bank. I admit, I thought that was cute.
Me too.
2 minutes. Each assigned to complete one of three tasks in the heist process, potentially $250,000 is up for grabs. So, Brittany, let's start with you. Did this game hold your interest for the whole hour, or did you feel it was a large imposition on your time?
I had a hard time sticking with this show. Mm-hmm. I will say this. I think I came away from this thinking, okay, the guests they were interesting. They were engaging. They had a very surprising story as to how they all got together and how they were friends, how they knew each other. Lil Rel, super charming. I love him. I adore him. Whoever is dressing him for the show, the stylist for the show, you are doing your job. You deserve every cent of that paycheck and probably a bonus. But I just came away from it feeling like Lil Rel deserves a better game show. I think he's a totally amazing game show host. I think this is a really good vein and he should stay in it. But yeah, the show, it didn't hold my attention. I felt like there was no through line. I feel like with game shows, you kind of have to have some building to the tension and like some driving action, even though it's not a story.
Yeah.
But yeah, I just felt like this was totally lacking that. And I felt like there was just, I felt like the people who were on stage were so much more interesting than the game that was being played, which it kind of should be like that. But I don't think the distance between those two things should be as great as they were on Small Time.
After watching the first episode of Small Fortune, I was thinking that why isn't there two teams sort of somehow playing off each other instead of just one team? Because that would create the tension, I think, that Brittany's missing. Because if it was like less about, do you want to spend a little bit more money on a practice shot? It would be about how, like, there could be like a name that tune style. I can do this in one try. I can do this in two tries or something. Right. Or just a simple timed race to the finish for the challenge at hand. And this was 5 minutes of gameplay in a 45-minute bag. It was crazy how much filler there was in this show. And to introduce practice runs before the actual for the money shot robs it of all the tension. You're like, okay, absolutely. I know how this is played. I know how they're going to attack it. And then when you get to the fourth try or the third try where they're actually playing it, it's like,
I don't care anymore.
Don't care.
I also think that like it's so rare for game show contestants to be that sort of charming and focus pulling. Like usually it's like, so you have a stamp collection. It's like, oh my God, why? Like nobody cares. Get back to the game. But if in future episodes, the guests are sort of like Dudley, then I'm really not sure what the draw is. Like, I liked this. I thought a lot of things about it were charming, and the fact that it was completely low stakes, evidently, for everybody involved was like, now that we're back to needing multi-generational gathering viewing that will delight, but then again, offend no one in the group, this is perfect for that. The diorama are very clever. The names like Fenway Park. I mean, I'm sorry. That's great. But it's like, yeah, like this is just not enough. This is like not enough of the good things about the concept. And then it's too reliant on certain other good things that were a crapshoot, like the guests being compelling this time.
I have noticed, though, the other terrible Fox game show, the Cherry's Wild, the one with Jason Biggs. That was another one where Brittany's making a face.
Yeah, Jason Biggs.
Jason Biggs hosted a game show this year
that
was sponsored by Pepsi, and it was on Fox. Mm. It was called Cherry's Wild. And it was also just a team like playing against the clock or like the odds or trying to just build their bank. It was like there were no opponents in that one either, other than bad luck, I guess. But they also, that was another one where it seemed like they really spent a lot of time casting people who were going to be really vivacious on camera. So I just wonder if that's like part of the network brief, especially now that ABC is so dominant with all of their celebrity-driven, like, revival game shows, like, you know, To Tell the Truth and Match Game and blah, blah, blah. If there's like more pressure on network shows to like cast people who are going to be really engaging. Because I noticed that, too. They were fun to watch, but at the same time, it's like, just get to flicking. My God. Your personal story is cute, but it's like there's three, as Dave said, there's 5 minutes of gameplay in this. And it was just like, even with the commercials cut out, it was like, get on with it.
I think you figured out the title, too. Shouldn't have been Small Fortune. It should have been called Get to Flicking.
Get to flicking, yeah. I mean, at the end of it, I was like, this is a Quibi show. Like, it should be one game should just be a five-minute thing, and then you're out for, like, you know, $500 or something. Like, just lower all of the stakes even more.
But what did you guys think of the actual games themselves? Like, did you find them entertaining? Like, if you, never mind the fact that they kind of, like, spoil it with the practice shots.
Right.
If you just came into it for one play of it, would you find it engaging?
Brittany, you go first.
If the show were shorter, yes.
Yeah.
I think that, like, I totally, totally agree with Sarah. Like, I love the fact that, like, the dioramas that they make are so thoughtfully put together.
Yes.
And, like, the scale of them is so perfect.
So
like, even
thorough.
At that wedding, I think it was, they had these little tiny plates on a table. And I was just like, they're so cute. This is perfect. The scale is perfect. I think I would be into it. I think if it were shorter, and also, again, going back to the tension thing, if there was either higher stakes, like more money on the line, or if the money was for something more compelling,
right.
Then maybe I would feel a little bit more like, I don't know, like those near misses would feel a little bit more, I feel a more emotionally connected to, I mean, I don't know, I mean, that's kind of like a strong term I feel like to use for a game show. I want some drama. I want some investment. And I think that maybe shorter gameplay and like a more compelling reason to win would make me feel a little bit more into the games themselves. But I thought that they were otherwise working. I just think that like the show was kind of robbed of that by not having enough stakes.
I think the long-term problem for this show is something that it's going to run into that holy moly solved, which is once I know all the games that they are playing, or once I'm familiar with all the golf holes that they put on, what's going to keep me coming back? Holy moly has the hosts, which keep it engaging. I mean, they're all kind of dumb, stupid little concepts. The host here has nobody to play off. It all depends on the guests that he has to go off, and they're not going to be great all the time. And even the great ones, it's not the same as having, you know, two professionals back and forth that feed off each other's energy. Like your whole, like, I mean, we always compare these things to Holy Moly because right now it's the gold standard for a very simple, dumb concept being elevated by talent. Mm-hmm. And after you know that there are 10 games that they play over and over again, but and maybe they'll surprise you. It's going to be a different one all the time. They're small little things. Maybe they can do new ones for each show. But like this first show, there was, you have flicking, dropping, or stacking. And those are all the games all dressed up in different ways.
Oh, there was also the tablecloth.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, and the pulling of the tablecloth. Yeah. But like, how are they going to keep that interesting week after week without the added benefit of like some really strong chemistry up top?
All right. Let's move on to our other crappy game show, Crime Scene Kitchen, which premiered May 26th. It will air Wednesdays on Fox. I guess the premise of this is it's for people who like baking competitions but think they're too straightforward. We have six teams of two experienced bakers in the pilot. Six more, we're told, are coming in the next episode. Only two of these teams seem to be professional bakers from what I could tell. And they're let loose in the titular Crime Scene Kitchen, which they have to inspect for clues as to what was baked there. Like, four cake pans in the drying rack means it's a four-layer cake. The spice jars that are dirty show which ones were used. You can lick a spoon to see what kind of frosting was made and so on. So the bakers decide what they think was made in the kitchen, and then they make it themselves. And if more than one team guesses right, the superior version of whatever it was wins. And the judges are TV chef Curtis Stone, a.k.a. Mr. Lindsay Price, and YouTube star Yolanda Gamp with two P's. And our host is Joel McHale. So, Sarah, let us start with you. Since you were already mad about this show in our last podcast, did the actual episode live down to your expectations, or was it not as bad as you thought?
It was not, I mean, it was not as bad as I thought, because how could it be? But why did they call it Crime Scene Kitchen? Why didn't they call it Half-Baked Theory or Culinary Detective or I Am Not a Crockpot or any of the 15 things that I came up with in 30 seconds? And yeah. I am not good at this. I suck at titles. Ask anyone I've ever worked with. So there's that. There's the fact that, once again, this is like, I don't know, 15, 18 minutes of content. Taffy pulled out to 42 to 45 minutes so that Joel McHale can Joel McHale around. Like, I like Joel McHale, but okay. And then it's padded with like 17 talking head interviews of the various teams being like, this is, you know, this is high stakes because someone's going home. I'm like, but you're not going to be killed. Like, it's a baking show. I mean, if someone's actually going to be killed, like, then call it Crime Scene Kitchen, that it's like, well, this will be a crime scene because the person who finishes last is actually going to be, like, I don't even know, dished to death.
Dial M for meal.
Yeah. I did sort of get sucked into the dessert round and the wrong guesses, because I've watched all the other cooking and baking shows, and it was sort of like Bakewell tart. Like, what are you doing? There's cherries in that. Like, I did get sucked into it, but here's another problem, which was not Crime Scene Kitchen's fault. Top Chef just did an episode where they're like, make a dish, write down the recipe, and then our guest judges have to replicate it. And whoever gets closest to each other / writes a good recipe. Like, it was an excellent challenge that I hope they do again. Mm-hmm. But Top Chef is the class of this genre.
Yeah.
So that's unfortunate timing for Crime Scene Kitchen. But this is just like, I don't know. It's like kind of every lazy thinking, why is this even a competition? Why are you dragging true crime into this? Like, I know why. I live in the capitalist world, but like, why? Mm-hmm. Like, this just doesn't really need to exist.
I have a question though about the title. What crimes are exactly being committed in this kitchen?
I think the crime scene aspect is just like you're inspecting it like a criminalist.
Oh, well, thank you, Tara. I didn't realize that. But what I'm saying is like it's more like a Hardy Boy mystery clue set, right?
Right.
It's like, remember it was a couple of weeks ago, I even forget what show we're talking about, but it's basically, it's like, cobwebs don't burn, and that's how the case is solved.
Right.
Like, this is that thing. It's like, sure, there were four pie tins in the sink, but one of them still had the label on the back, so you know it was only three pie tins were used. Like, it's that kind of thing. But what they really need is a bloody corpse on the floor to really tell the Crime Scene Kitchen part.
Well, yeah, or it's like, you know, the actual challenge is that you're in a kitchen at the same time as an actual forensics team, and you're all like elbowing each other, and they're like, you can't use the cinnamon, it's evidence. Like, all right, that's all horribly disrespectful. But then it's like, this, aside from this name, which is like a misnomer, this is just superfluous, too long, and doing things that other shows do better. Like, I'm not actually going to storm out of a room in which it's on, but the fact is that the rooms in which this will be on are like a hospital waiting room. Yeah. Honestly, like, this is what this is.
Yeah.
Oh God, Curtis Stone. The most, possibly the most boring. Is this the Joel Kinnaman of celebrity chefs?
Yes.
I ask the panel.
Yeah.
But yeah, I'm not enraged, but I'm not in sore salt either, as okay. predicted.
Brittany, are you a watcher of baking shows? And did this one hold your interest?
I am a watcher of baking shows, but more specifically, I'm a watcher of this show called, I think the title is Leaves a Lot to Be Desired, but Best Leftovers Ever,
uh-huh.
or something like that on yep. Netflix, which had a similar vibe to this show for me. So, like, my expectations for the show, even I do also like Joel McHale, but my expectations for the show were really low. And also, I watched Small Fortune after I watched Crime Scene Kitchen.
Mm-hmm.
So,
mm-hmm.
Crime Scene Kitchen, it hit. I loved it.
Huh. Okay.
I mean, it wasn't like, I do think that like what it would benefit from is maybe being not on a network, like being on something like Netflix where this, right. each episode could be like 38 minutes.
Yes. Yeah.
Do totally. You know what I'm saying?
100%.
It needs that nailed it energy and pace.
Exactly.
Well, the other thing is like they have two rounds of play, but they're exactly the same. Like there's no difference yeah. between them. So there's no build.
No build. That was the thing that surprised me. And when I got to the other thing is too, is like I got to the, I'm not great with directions. So if someone gives me directions one time, it's not going to sink in. So by the time I got to the end of the episode, when someone, I couldn't tell, I was like, is someone a winner? Is someone going home?
Right.
Are all of these people replaced by a new set of people right. in the next episode?
Yeah, I didn't get that
I
either.
Didn't understand until like the very last 20 seconds. And I was like, oh, so two people were voted off this week. Not voted off, but whatever. And then like, then like, so it's going to be this same group of people. Once I got to the end of the episode and understood it was going to be the same group of people for the whole season, then I was like, oh, I understand why they had more interviews with people, but why didn't they just do like the sort of like Great British Bake Off or like Project Runway thing of like learning things, like getting you to provide actual footage of you cooking at home or
yeah.
any of those things that sort of build you out as a character. It gave me none of the signposts that a show like that would typically use if you were going to have contestants on for an entire season. Mm-hmm. I didn't get that much background on the contestants. So like, I kind of enjoyed, I think, witnessing some of their picadillos. Because some of them, especially this one lady, oh my gosh, I think she guessed the Bakewell tart in the first round and then the Italian flag, the Italian cream cake or whatever yeah. in the second round.
Mm-hmm. Tweeling.
And I was like, you love to be wrong. You love to be wrong. This lady, it's like she was totally dead wrong the first round and the second round came back around and she trusted her instincts again, which she should not have because she was wrong. But yeah, I would say like it's total mindless programming. That is a little bit more my style. Like low stakes, like charming host, mm-hmm. don't really have to understand fully what's going on.
Yep.
I like Small Fortune, but when I compare the two, Small Fortune, I had to like hold a lot of information in my head at once mm-hmm. to follow what was happening. I don't have that bandwidth. I was recently diagnosed with ADHD. I cannot follow Small Fortune.
Gotcha.
But Crime Scene Kitchen, is it one last thought I had though. Something that I did not think they did a good job with was establishing, I agree. I think they should have had some sort of backstory for the crime, the way that children's shows do. Like,
yeah.
When you think of like Carmen Sandiego,
uh-huh.
you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Or, like Legends of the Hidden Temple, when they yeah. would give you some goofy scenario that would explain what you were seeing.
Right.
They did not have that. And I think that was a little lazy. I think they could have come up with something else. Mm-hmm. But the second thing is the parameters for how they should be thinking about the scene were not well established at all, which is why I think in the first round, you saw so many different groups of people or so many pairs, like, completely guessing wrong. Like yeah. this one lady, I mean, I love this mother and daughter. I think they were mother and daughter, or were they mm-hmm. friends in the military? I can't remember.
Carolyn and Caroline.
One of them,
Or, oh, wait.
Oh, no, I'm thinking of
the militaries. I think they're just friends.
Yeah, okay. It was Aaron and I can't remember the other woman's name, but
yeah, that's the military ladies.
Yeah, Amanda and Aaron, they were killing me because one of them was like, you know, in the military, I was known for my sense of smell or something like that. And so she's like sniffing all the pots. I'm like, girl, I don't know if this is going to help you win. So it's like, they didn't know, people weren't told, like, are you supposed to smell things?
Right.
Are you supposed to taste things? Like, are you looking at things in the dishwasher? Are you looking at things that are in the, like in the fridge, but are unopened, like a red herring or something like that.
Well,
but
the editing was also a bit confusing as to their time in the kitchen, going off what you said, that it's sort of like you're seeing all of them in parallel, like doing various different things. And like, I understand from a story build point of view why it's done that way, but it's like, I would like a better sense of how long a minute feels to these people. Yeah. Who are like opening cupboards and going through the whole kitchen.
Yes.
Otherwise, it's like there's no tension for me because I don't know either. Like I'm not in the crime scene. So they need a little bit more. Carmen Sandiego is an excellent comparison. Like they need to make it a little more, not interactive, but just, I don't know.
Give a narrative
something.
To it.
Yeah. Yes. Like the raspberries have been replaced by Folgers crystals. Like anything to sort of be like, you know, something the contestants don't, because otherwise it's a little weird.
Right. And they have a whole, like one of the whole skeins of Hallmark mystery movies I happen to know is there's ones that are like for bakers and they all have like baking puns in the name. It's like, you know, if there's like, you know, murder by pie, that's a terrible one, but like something like that, there's the, if Hallmark can do it, it's not in too poor taste for Fox.
Yeah.
We started a CSI watch recently and Gil Grissom tastes more inedible things than I saw people taste on this, on Crime Scene Kitchen. So there's something wrong with that when this guy's licking rocks and
or goo bones.
Or bones or whatever. Oh. And these people are like, I don't know, it might be some sort of, put it on your tongue, you'll discover there's coconut in it.
Mm-hmm.
Why are you on this show?
Yeah.
And just getting back to what Brittany was saying about like having some sort of characterization in Small Fortune and perhaps also in Crime Scene Kitchen. Doesn't it seem like the right time that Small Fortune, you set it up as, you know, because it's set up to be this big caper that there should be some sort of like money bags, Jeff Bezos, baddie billionaire character that you're actually taking money from. Like that's the conceit.
Yes.
Like, is it not the perfect time for that right now?
Yes.
Missed opportunity.
100%. All right. Well, let's go around the horn and just answer. If you had a gun to your head, you had to watch one. I think we already know Brittany's answer, but let's start with you. Which of these two shows would you watch?
I'm 100% watching Crime Scene Kitchen. I actually told my fiance, we are going to watch this season of Crime Scene Kitchen. Best Leftovers Ever is gone, and now this is my replacement.
Okay. Sarah?
Small Fortune.
I think I also would go Small Fortune. What do you think, Dave?
I'm absolutely going to vote with Brittany on Crime Scene Kitchen. And just one last thought. I mean, it's obviously a show that's like, how can we take the gentle, simple concept of Great British Bake Off and make it needlessly complicated? I get that.
Yeah.
But one of the things I'm curious about what they're going to do with the rest of the season is, because this is a show for normal folks and you can't assume that all these people are like really into baking and know what the hell a Bakewell tart is. Mm-hmm. I didn't. The only two things I knew were the two things that cakes was. So I'm wondering how complicated the solutions are going to be in order to keep me as a viewer engaged. Like it's, well, I wonder what this one is. I bet it's chocolate cake. It's chocolate cake. Like it's going to be stuff like that. Or you're actually going to have like, you know, it's like, is the most complicated thing they're going to have is like flan or something. That's what I'm worried about, where the clues are going to be for simple sort of mass market known quantities.
100%. Right. When the people were it's like, really it's a hummingbird thought. Cake, like it's never going to be a hummingbird cake.
Yeah, because
cake.
Nobody knows what that is. Exactly. It is time to go around the dial talking about things we've been watching on TV recently. First off, Tara.
I'm going to do lowbrow, highbrow this week, starting with The Friends Reunion on HBO Max. Obviously, there was no way I wasn't going to watch this. As listeners of this podcast know, I love Friends, despite knowing how problematic it is. But this reunion, it premiered on HBO Max May 28th. It was so overcovered in the entertainment, like, press, which it is part of my job to read, that I knew every beat of it. going in just from reading headlines, like the surprise guests, the big revelations from the interviews, how each of the friends reacted to being on the set again. Like, by the time I learned the guy they got to interview them in front of a live audience was James Corden, I was like, do I have to watch this? But I did. James Corden apparently got the job because one of the producers of the reunion also produces his late night show. He was awful. Because he is awful. He's a very bad interviewer. Everyone who complains about how sycophantic Jimmy Fallon is, and he is, would probably go instantly insane if they watched one James Corden interview. Our past and future guest, Brandy Brown, suggested on Twitter that Aisha Tyler should have interviewed them, which, yes, at the very least, she should have been in it somewhere as one of the few people of color to have an actual arc on the show spanning more than one season. But if she isn't there because she decided she didn't want to be the token black friend who was supposed to insulate the show from criticism about how white it was, fair. To my knowledge, she has not commented on the reunion. I did look. But I can't chalk the inanity of Corden's questions entirely up to him sucking at his job, because the six Friends cast members are also executive producers on the reunion, which means obviously there were questions they were never going to answer, even if it had occurred to him to ask them, which it wouldn't. Like, in the outtakes we see, which were frankly the only reason to watch the reunion, there's a lot of evidence of Matthew Perry ruining takes to get a laugh from the studio audience. And he also says of the way the audience energy fired them up, I felt like I was going to die if I didn't get a laugh, which, like, it shows. But as we all now know, during this time, he was also dealing with addiction issues. Like, does he now feel that played into the way he played his role? What was going on with him during that time? How is it for him now looking back on this? Like, obviously not something they were going to get addressed if they had this much control over it. And similarly, the question of the show's lack of diversity. Series co-creator Kevin Bright recently acknowledged this isn't something they could get away with if they were trying to get the show on the air in 2021. But he said that in a THR Hollywood Reporter interview last week, not the reunion. So we did get walk-ons from relevant people, Elliot Gould and Christina Pickles, who played the Geller parents, Larry Hankin, who played Mr. Heckles, Maggie Wheeler, who played Janice, and Thomas Lennon, Joey's hand twin in one episode who does not say anything. It's just like, here's my hands. Hi, goodbye. And James Michael Tyler, who played Gunther for like 3 seconds on Zoom in this thing, which is so cringy, given he's the actor who's in the most episodes of the show other than the leads, although not as cringy as Lady Gaga doing Smelly Cat with Lisa Kudrow or Justin Bieber in Ross's Sputnik costume on a runway for the live audience. Like,
no.
What?
No.
Was he even alive when the show went off the air? Don't think he was, but anyway. The rest of the commentators and guests are insane choices. Like, Reese Witherspoon, fine. She played Rachel's sister. But I sure don't care what Kit Harington or Malala think of Friends, and I especially don't need David Beckham to do a full recap of his favorite episode, nor does anyone else watching this, because at this point, if you've never seen Friends, it's because you've affirmatively chosen not to. And anyone still watching at the late moment when he shows up is definitely a super fan. So,
or
like, this
a
might have been a
TV critic. God. Right. Just might felt so sorry for the Friends industrial complex last week. Ugh.
Yeah. So this could have been a cute treat for fans if it had just dropped, like, when HBO Max launched, or not. Like, maybe the delays in producing it had no effect on how it came out, and it was always going to be this embarrassing. You do not have to watch it. This version of the theme song that plays near the end tells you the vibe. Dave, please play the clip.
Oh, no.
Lies. This is the Band of Brothers.
Wait, seriously?
Oh, yeah. It's
real. What, do you think I hired an orchestra to make it?
Oh, my
gosh. The best way that I can describe it is after the show was over, at a party or any kind of social gathering, if one of us bumped into each other, that was it. That was the end of the night.
I just left that on, even with his voice, so you could hear the "it's always stuck in second gear" part of the theme song by, like, a symphony. Ugh, the only thing that redeems this reunion in terms of its reason for existing is the Joey as Irish dad meme that broke out on Twitter from this one pose of him, like, sitting with his legs sticking out and his pants on his stomach. And all, you know, comments that go over it of, like, what an Irish dad says when he's 3 pints in after mass and waiting for the Carvery dinner and stuff. So I'll link a collection of the best ones in the show notes. To wash the taste of that out of your mouth, here's what you should watch on HBO Max, season 2 of Legendary, which has been so much fun. I talked about this during the first season. This is the drag ball competition show in which 5-member teams from different houses compete to be superior house and win $100,000 at the end of the season. And the artistry is, to my untrained eye, much higher than what we saw in season one. A recent pop art-themed episode was especially strong and fun. Jameela Jamil, a judge and executive producer, is still Jameela-ing around. But what it's pretty easy to ignore, it's easy to ignore her when the rest of the judging panel, who are stylist La Roach, Megan Thee Stallion, voguing superstar Leomi Maldonado, and then they have a rotating fifth guest judge every episode.
Was La Roach was on Latter Day America's Next Top Model, yes?
Was he? I don't know. I don't think I was watching it then, but probably.
He's very fun. I like him.
Yeah, the judges are great. But what I think I love the most this season is the MC, Deshaun Wesley. His looks every week have been spectacular, but especially in a week when we watched one very irritating reality competition show host, Joel McHale, in my opinion. What Deshaun Wesley adds to Legendary stood out to me even more. And to give you an idea, at the end of each episode, the two bottom houses each send one member to compete in a Vogue-off. And while they're battling, Deshaun Wesley does a version of this. This is from this season's first episode. Please play the clip.
Let's go. Let's go. Let's go. I want to see redemption, bitch. I want to see redemption now. I want to see redemption, dipshit. Shake, fit it up right now. I want to see redemption, bitch. Say, I want to see redemption now. I want to see redemption, bitch. You want to give it right now. Now giving it, bam. Giving it, ow. Giving it, bam. The cat, tag, act, your bam. Ow. I want to give it. I want to serve it. I want to give it. Yes, it's the bam. I want to give it. Want to serve it. Want to give it. Then the cat, tag, act, your bam. Ow. Give me redemption, bitch. Give me redemption, bitch. Give me redemption, bitch. Redemption. On a count of three, hold that pole for me. Me. 1001, 1001, 2002, 2002, 3003, and hold that pole for me. Me, 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 ow.
His other thing that I don't think he did last season was he won't say no shade. He says no Sade, which I love so much. But anyway, I kind of want him in an app to get me like hype for my life. Like when I'm running out of steam writing a review, he's in my ear going, I want to see a critic, bitch. I want to see a critic or whatever. Legendary is great. Drops new episodes on Thursdays.
What about GPS?
Oh, yes. Also great as a GPS voice. Turn left, bitch. No. Anyway.
Oh, my God. Yes.
So, yeah. Legendary on Thursdays, HBO Max. And speaking of new episodes dropping Thursday, it is the week when we, on our Again With This Patreon, will be dropping Again With Them, our recap of Jenny and Tori's 90210 podcast, 90210MG. Five big episodes this May. So, check that out. Patreon.com/againwiththis. And of course, we're still recapping Melrose Place on the main podcast. We are almost to the bonkers, extra hot, great canon inducted season 3 finale. So check those out too if you have not been listening at againwiththis90210.com.
Brittany, what do you got?
Okay, I have my favorite reality show, Married at First Sight, comes on Lifetime last week. Just finished the 12th season.
I'll just stop you right there and say, I have checked in on the season 12. So our listeners do know about Chris and his, the other lady. He got pregnant and how he sucks. God. So we're up to date.
Okay, good. Okay, so season 12 was the, I think, messiest season of Married at First Sight, which I have mixed feelings about. Because on one hand, I think it really put the show on the map for people outside of just like serious Married at First Sight devotees like myself.
Yep.
So it was really fun to be able to like use the mess as like a hook to get like other sort of like MAFS adjacent people into watching the show. And I also like love the fact that it had so many people having really ridiculous conversations about the antics of specifically Chris on the show.
Yep.
Chris, as you know, is like the villain of this season. He's a total mess. Tara was saying he's a complete mess. He's a mess and a half and a liar and a scammer and not even a good scammer. I don't even want to call him a scammer because I feel like scammers achieve something.
Yeah.
He just lies constantly and gets nowhere. And it's so strange. But one of the highlights I think of this season was that like this is the first season where like Clubhouse, the app, was a thing. And so I started listening to a Clubhouse chat on Thursday nights with my fiance from like 7 to like midnight. We would cast it on the TV, listen to it while we're eating dinner, like talk to each other during the Clubhouse chat. Talk to the people, even though they can't hear us. Like, we would never get go on mic on during the Clubhouse chat. And then progressively, like, make it toward the bedroom and then put, like, my fiance's phone in between us and listen to the Clubhouse chat until we went to sleep. We're engaged, by the way. But yeah, Married at First Sight, it's just, I think it's the best. I never was into love reality shows, but I think it's the best love reality show, specifically because they start off with the fantasy and then they just like plunk the couple back into their real life. You start off at the altar, you go on a honeymoon where you're forced to spend time together with this person who you don't really know. Sometimes it goes well, sometimes it goes terribly. And then you're forced to live with them when you come back to your hometown where you both are. The thing that's interesting to me about Married at First Sight, as opposed to something like Love Island or The Bachelor, is that because those are shows that pull in people from all across the country, sometimes all around the world, mm-hmm. there's always this sort of built-in, built-in drama of like, will they make it or not because they live in separate cities?
Right.
But there's also right. this convenient sort of like off-ramp if you really don't want things to work. You'd be like, well, I live in Alabama, you live in Missouri. Never the twain shall meet. That's mm-hmm. it. With Married at First Sight, they basically remove all the obstacles and force you to be in a relationship together. Because and like they don't like keep you sequestered in some like Las Vegas hotel, like with Love Island mm-hmm. America season two, where there's like no escape and you're not living in the real world and you're super sequestered. Like, no, these are people that continue to spend time with their families, spend time with their friends,
go to work,
sometimes go by their old apartments, yeah. drive their cars, mm-hmm. go to work. And again, also most of the people who come on the show are regular people who don't have any desire really to become famous. I have noticed that in recent seasons, there are contestants who have kind of spun their Married at First Sight sort of quasi stardom into like influencer deals that allow them to take free trips or get mm-hmm. a lot of like Fashion Nova at a discounted price or for free. But I mean, as sure. far as like real celebrity, that's not why people go on the show. People yep. actually seem to go on the show to fall in love. So it's great because some people actually really do fall in love, but it's also great in a more dastardly way because the expectations of the contestants are so high.
Yep.
The expectations are high, the chance for conflict is high, and then encouraged by the show. But then also, too, it's like the same things that end up tripping these couples up or the same reasons why they don't work. They come back to the same reasons why relationships don't work in real life. And I just find that so refreshing in a weird way. Like so many other reality shows, they sort of end with like one person becoming an American citizen or like, you know what I mean, being accepted into somebody's, you know, very like family who's into a certain religious sect that's mm-hmm. really small in the United States or something really dramatic and intense. Really what the show Married at First Sight does is just bring together people who are more or less average, who are just really desperately want to be married above all else. And sometimes it goes great. I would say maybe 15 to 20% of the time it goes great. And the other 80 to 85% of the time it goes terribly. And that's what I love to watch.
This is sort of what I like about, Love After Lockup and Life After Lockup, that it's like there is the, I mean, first of all, it's like a fairly good window given the network into like the realities of post-carceral life. And especially in the last year when it's like COVID was really fucking with the production like in sort of like next level way compared to other productions. But like, I think that there are enough people in the Life After Lockup process who are like really sincere about making it work with mm-hmm. the person on the inside / outside. But then they're all like, they think they're not naive about how it's going to be when parole finally happens. But then it's like, you know, some of these people have been inside since they were 17 years old. They don't know how to operate a smartphone. And then the minute they do, they get busted texting, like there's like eggplant emojis and they're sort of like, but I don't even know what that, like, I don't know what an eggplant emoji is, like plausible deniability. You could sort of get away with it. They're like Brooks Hadland and Shawshank that they're like, they didn't have cars when I went in. But there is that like sincerity to it. And some of them do want to be famous or like not bitter about it, but others are just like, you know, I live in like literally a one stoplight town in Alabama. This is my shot to find love. is, you know, prisoner number A25F4 who says all the right things. And then he comes out and he's like, I need all these ingredients to continue cooking meth. And poor Angela. I mean, yeah. Anyway, there is a, given how like trashy it seems like on the tin, I think there is this, documentary worthwhileness to both of them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I totally agree. It's like, my interest in Married at First Sight came about literally, no, actually it wasn't even organic. It was like the algorithm on Netflix after I finished watching Love is Blind. Mm-hmm. Netflix was like, here, watch season 9 of Married at First Sight. Another thing about Married at First Sight, it's one of the few love reality shows that like consistently shows a wide variety of Black couples, which is like really hard to find across love reality shows. I mean, that's why it was such a big deal last year with the, you know, the whole Black Bachelor situation.
Right.
And why it was such a big deal a few years ago when they had the first Black Bachelorette. I think that's probably what got me into it. Netflix showed me some art that showed a Black couple on a reality show. And I was like, what? I was like, huh? What is this?
Yeah.
And then I got into it from there. But yeah, I kind of felt like when I first started watching it, I wasn't sure. I was like, it has the sort of love reality genre been wrung dry? But no, to your point, Sarah, like there's still this sort of like, they found a way to engineer what feels as close to like an average relationship as you could really get in a reality TV show setting. And it's really impressive because it's like, sometimes it feels like if you talk about some of the events, I'd say season 12 aside, season 12 was wild. Season 12 aside, if you talk about most of the events that happen on a season of Married at First Sight, it doesn't sound like much. But when you're watching it, I think because they understand the scale of the drama on the show, they do a really good job of producing it and getting you into these people's like conflicts. But yeah, I love the season. I love this, the sort of season, what sort of thing, reunions, because they bring in this guy, Kevin Frazier, who I think he used to host Entertainment Tonight.
Yeah.
And now he just, I mean, he does lots of things, but now specifically he's like the guy for the Married at First Sight reunion every season. The frustrating thing about Married at First Sight is like all the couples are supposed to rely on this team of experts that sort of are supposed to counsel them through their marriage issues. Two of the experts are like mostly television personalities, although they do have some credentials. One of them, Dr. Pepper, she actually is like a real psychologist. She has participated in really intense Yale studies. She's been doing this for decades. I tend to trust her advice a little bit more, but even still, she can only give so much advice because the point of her role in the show is not really to be an expert. Her role in the show is really just to kind of like serve as a second host in sort of shepherding these couples through the process. Mm-hmm. But yeah, she and the other two sort of experts, they never go deep enough for me because they can't really, because they're sort of responsible for matching these couples. They can't really sometimes say, you don't need to be together. This isn't working. You're an unhealthy person, because that sort of like breaks the fourth wall a little bit too much of the show.
Yeah.
Right.
Kevin Frazier, though, on the reunions, he gets everybody in a room and asks the questions that you wanted them to ask all season. Yep. Like Kevin Frazier will be like, well, have you had sex yet? And Kevin Frazier will be like, I think actually that you weren't nice enough to Haley, Jacob. And I think that eating 8 eggs and a ribeye steak for every meal, it does not make a woman want to have sex with you. And I think that you need to take some responsibility for that. So I just love unadulterated Kevin Frazier time. I love every season of Married at First Sight, but when it gets to the end, you finally get that sweet reunion and you know that Kevin's going to get into it. It just feels so satisfying as a viewer. So I cannot recommend Married at First Sight enough. It is uncomfortable. It is excruciating. It is embarrassing. It reminds you sometimes of like some of your worst relationship moments, but then also it's really sweet when you least expect it. So I can't recommend it enough. I've spent so many hours of my life watching the show and I am ready in 7 weeks to get into season 13. Yep. I'm completely 100% ready. So that's my whole thing this week.
And your plug is also Married at First Sight related.
My plug, oh yes. And my plug is an essay that I wrote about the reasons why I have spent more time watching Married at First Sight than planning my own wedding. Harper's Bazaar Digital. you can find it there. I'm biased, but it's a good read.
And I'd like to congratulate me and Sarah for not interrupting with a list of other important soda-based doctors on the show. Because I was thinking about it.
Mr. Pibb.
Yes, yeah. Mr. Pibb. Is there a Dr. Pibb? Yeah, we did it anyway, didn't we? Sarah, anybody?
I was going to talk about this very dark, frustrating sort of, not because it's bad, but because the case is just a lot.
We've heard enough about Crime Scene Kitchen for 1 week, Sarah.
Well, yeah. Franche documentary. It's on Netflix. It's called Who Killed Little Gregory? It's five parts. I recommend it, but first of all, it's real dark. And second of all, I just bowled into Brittany's section of Around the Dial and was like, hey, I'm still watching Life After Lockup and trying to make it out like it's a Frederick Wiseman joint, which whatever, like it's good and worthwhile, but it, you know, calm down, Sarah. Anyway, I would like to recommend Who Killed Little Gregory, but I don't want to I don't want to ruin the vibe. I feel like we have a good flow, so I'm just going to say you can read my review of that and many other true crime properties at a newsletter that I do every weekday with Eve Beatty. It's called Best Evidence, and you can find it at bestevidence.fyi. We would love to have you subscribe and recommend things for us to review for you.
All right, so there is a Disney Plus Star Wars show that's been on for a few weeks called The Bad Batch, which is a terrible title, but another one of their animated shows. And these animated shows are like not really my like thing. I love The Mandalorian. I'm looking forward to the other live action stuff, but The Clone Wars never really like really sunk its claws into me. And this one's kind of the same. It's a lot like The Mandalorian setup. Like there's these outcast guys. They're not quite bounty hunters, but they're almost bounty hunters. They've become mercenaries through circumstance. And there's like every episode is a fetch quest. And there's like a young kid to protect. It's very similar in basic structure to The Mandalorian. So that's sort of like, really? Like your follow-up is like Mandalorian again? but the general premise is there's a squad of clone troopers and they are not quite the same. They are the Bad Batch. You can't fully control them. They're kind of like the Star Wars equivalent of the Dirty Dozen or like the Galactic Dirty Near Dozen. Mm-hmm. And they all have their very tropey skill set and personalities. I swear there is one that is basically just a Rambo. They gave him a red headband. It's like ridiculous how incredibly tropey this whole set is. I mean, that works in some regards, but really the guy that looks exactly like Sylvester Stallone from Rambo, which is another problem because all these clone troopers are all supposed to be Temuera Morrison from Star Wars 2, where he played Jango Fett, and all the clones are him. And these clones, they don't really talk like him. They don't look like him. Some of them look just like as white as me. Other people besides me have noticed somehow. And they're like, why are they kind of like way whiter than the actor they're based on, but also like earlier iterations of them in the same animation style? And they're totally right. Like there is no reason why. Like one of them's got dirty blonde hair. Look at the source. That dude's got the blackest of black hair. At least when, you know, when he was cloned, he did. Now he's an older gentleman like us all who has white hair. But these whitewashing accusations really, they stick on this show. Like the show itself is entertaining. The animation is pretty good, except when they're walking and then they look like action figures for some reason. They can't figure out how to make them walk. There's really good set pieces. The action's okay. But then like at the end of the day, like somebody, and it's a problem with Star Wars that always has been, they just always do something wrong when it comes to characters of color. And then on top of all that, there's this whole other layer. The modern online Star Wars fan is a total monster, right? Yeah. So then on top of all that, you get this layer of, well, I don't see the problem because it doesn't affect me. Yeah. And it's just like, it's one of those things where if I wasn't a lifelong Star Wars fan and I came into it, somebody said in 2020, you should watch Star Wars. It's really fun. I'd be like, yeah, but the fans have repelled me from it. You know what I mean? Like I've had those shows in the past, not because they were ugly, but I've had like fandoms that are so cringy and over the top and salesman to the degree where you're like, well, now you've turned me off it because it's like, you're too much.
It's like being a Barb.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's like where it's like, I could get into Nicki Minaj, but.
So that's sort of like where I am, where like I now have to like stop reading about Star Wars stuff online because it's become so toxic.
Yeah.
And I don't understand how these people are attracted to Star Wars in the first place, because Star Wars is such a like a kind of wholesome, simple, good versus bad. The bad people want to control other people. Like, it's not a complicated story.
No.
Clicks for some people, and they're so bad. They're so bad. It makes me sad. Anyways, it's animation, and I know Disney is sort of very careful about not George Lucasing stuff, but this is something I would say they definitely can go back on and retool the animation and make it right, because there's no reason why that needs to be like that. It's not a new problem either, because, like, Finn... When they released in China, suddenly, like, Finn disappeared from the poster. And so there's, like, this willingness at Disney to erase a character from their marketing because they're black, because it doesn't sell. When you can see concrete things like that, everything else that happens with it, you're like, you won't give them the benefit of the doubt.
Yeah. Right?
And I don't think you should.
Yeah.
Hello, Extra Hot Great. This is Kimberly here with a canon submission for Dairy Girls, Season 1, Episode 2. In case you're not familiar with Dairy Girls, it's about a group of high school students at an all-girls except for James Catholic school in Londonderry, Northern Ireland in the mid-90s. Almost every episode follows a similar arc. The girls are trying to accomplish something. They have a small moment of unearned confidence or triumph. Then they screw it all up, make it worse when they try to fix it, and just when everything has gone completely to shit, the credits roll. In this episode, the gang wants to go on a school trip to Paris, but they can't afford the fee. They decide to get jobs, and Michelle steals the entire notice board from the local chippy. They get caught, because of course they do, and instead of getting paying jobs, they now have to clean the entire chippy for free. They somehow make it even more disgusting than when they began, and start a fire in the shop owner's upstairs apartment. Their parents try to deflect blame by tying them to the radiator and pretending the IRA did it, a copycat of a crime that actually happened to Aaron's Uncle Colm, but they are as inept as the kids. They get caught, and they are all banned from the chip shop, consigned to eating pizza instead of fish fry on Fridays, which is just not as nice. Here's why I think this episode is canon-worthy. Number one, Sister Michael. As principal of the school, Sister Michael is played with perfect subtlety by Chauvin McSweeney.
Before I dismiss you for the weekend, a few announcements. On Monday morning, several of our year 13s will face their GCSE maths reset. Now, I know how daunting reset examinations can be, so if anyone is feeling anxious or worried, or even if you just want to chat, please, please do not come crying to me. Let me see what else.
Come on, come on, come on, the fuck.
Notice from Mr. McCauley. This year's destination for the Euro Trotters trip will be dramatic pause. Did you actually want me to do the dramatic pause? Interesting. Paris, it's going to be Paris. If you need any further information, there is a stall in the foyer. Sadly, I am unable to come on this one as I despise the French.
Every line reading and facial expression is absolutely flawless. Right before the clip, the school choir sings an a cappella rendition of Love Is All Around, and the muted horror and disgust on her face is amazing. And someone accidentally reading a script direction out loud is a joke we've seen many times before. But the way she reacts, with mild disbelief and disdain that the teacher thought she, Sister Michael, would actually do a dramatic pause, makes it feel fresh. We've also seen plenty of over-it-all school administrators before, but Sister Michael is more nuanced. She's not negligent. Her snark is harsh, but not cruel. And the writing never takes her too far the other way either, into sappy, deep down she has a heart of gold territory. She's just a nun with a very limited number of fucks left, and she's not going to just dole them out right and left. Number two, Orla's physical comedy. Orla is the dim but good-natured member of the group. She doesn't drive the plot, she's usually just around for the ride. But she delivers great one-liners and does brilliant physical work in the background, adding texture to every scene. For For example, there's a scene in which Orla is eating a huge rainbow pacifier-shaped lollipop behind Aaron, Claire, and Michelle, who are enthusing about Paris. First, it gets stuck on her school tie, and then when she turns her head, it gets stuck in her hair, and she just picks all the hair off and keeps eating it. I didn't notice it until, like, the fourth time I watched the episode, but now it makes me laugh every time. Number 3, James's opinions on a fry-up. Poor wee James is the fish out of water of the show. A Brit who was abandoned in Derry when his mother went back to London without telling him, and the only boy at an all-girls school because everyone assumed he'd get beaten up at the boys' school for being English. Nothing shows how apart and frustrated he feels than when he's trying to explain that he just doesn't want anything from the chip shop, and everyone else is genuinely perplexed.
Oi, I'll not ask you again. A large curry body, Fenella, and don't be shy with the salt now.
What about the wee lamey?
Will Deco?
I'm okay, thanks.
What?
I don't really want anything.
You don't want anything?
How could you not want anything? It's lovely.
I just don't really fancy it, that's all.
I don't understand.
Are you not feeling well, James?
I don't like it, okay? It's too greasy. It's much, much too greasy. Even the smell of it makes me feel physically sick.
I'm sorry that you had to hear that, Fenella. You're a fucking embarrassment.
Get him out of here.
You heard the woman?
Number 4, the cleaning montage. The music, which is All Right by Supergrass, is upbeat, and the kids look determined and proud of themselves. But meanwhile, Aaron is leaking used fryer oil everywhere. Claire is taking out garbage bags with trash falling out the bottom. Orla is spraying cleaner around and on herself like it's perfume. Michelle scrubs about 1 square foot of stovetop before fucking off upstairs to raid Fanula's liquor cabinet. And James spends 5 hours scrubbing a single window pane with what he thinks is window cleaner. And since we can't go to the movie theater anymore, enjoy the sound of Aaron's shoes sticking to the floor she's been scrubbing.
It's still sticky? Why is it still sticky?
Is it worse than when we started?
I think it might be, yeah? Great.
Oh, I see. Yeah, this isn't windoline. This is mayonnaise.
Finally, I feel compelled to mention that in Aaron's living room, next to a framed portrait of Pope John Paul II, is a portrait of equal size and stature of the great Dolly Parton. I hope you enjoyed this episode of Derry Girls and that you see fit to add it to the extra hot great canon.
Thank you so much, Kimberly. Brittany, you chose this from our list of submissions. Please start us off.
I love this episode. I love Derry Girls. I'm still watching it. This was something that I discovered. It was always on my list of things to watch. And then, of course, I had some free time in the past 7 months, especially. Mm-hmm. And so I got around to watching it. And it's so funny. But this episode specifically, I love. I don't think this is like necessarily the intent of the episode. But I love it because it shows how preposterous the idea of a trust fund is. especially when you compare it to so many shows about teenagers that come from the West, especially from the United States. Like, even if the characters are not explicitly meant to be rich, which sometimes on some shows they are, but even if the characters aren't meant to explicitly be rich, they still live like rich people anyway. When you consider, like, the kinds of clothes that they wear, what their homes look like, the sorts of, you know, school trips that they just casually go on. I love the fact that these girls are so unaware of that type of like world that doesn't even like the existence of something like a trust fund doesn't even occur to them. Mm-hmm. Then they learn about it and then they get laughed at by their parents. Like, that whole sequence was just so perfect. On so many other shows, like, it would have ended up that they would have gotten jobs at the chip shop. And you know what I'm saying? Gone door to door throughout mm-hmm. their neighborhood and gotten the money that they needed to go on the trip. I love the fact that that did not happen whatsoever. And that also, like, the people in their family, the people that they're supposed to be looking to for role models are just as, like, ridiculous and, like, goofy and sort of trying to skate around doing the right thing as they are. Mm-hmm. Like, when they took Uncle Colm's story and decided to see if they can make that work in Finola's apartment to like use that to cover up the fact that they were trying to take flaming shots in her living room and set it accidentally on fire. I just thought it was so perfect. All of the actors on that show are great, but like the chemistry between the main set of teens and their timing and like the way that they're able to physically embody being a teenager is so next level. Like, so many of the actors I was shocked to learn are like in their mid 20s, and it blew my mind because I'm like, physically they embody what it means to like still be figuring out your limbs.
Yeah.
But also think that you should have access to your trust funds so that you can independently take a trip to Paris. Like, I just like, I love that show. I love the performances and I love that episode. Like, it's also the second episode of the series, which I think is remarkable. Yeah. I think it's like that episode, I think there are other shows that are good even, but other shows where it would take like a couple seasons to build up to an episode that was that complex and that was that funny and that took that many risks. Something I've been paying a lot of attention to, my fiance and I have been watching Sex and the City every night, like for hours. It's like the only show that I'm watching. Because he had never seen it when it came out. He'd never seen it, period. And so I was like, oh, allow me to like show you the mess of your life. Like, I can't wait. So we've been watching it every night for hours. And the thing I realized, aside from the character development, which I think actually on Sex and the City, they achieved a lot in 30-minute increments, is just how quickly the plot moves and how many storylines they're juggling every single episode. Mm-hmm. You can feel like things have substantially moved forward with each woman. All four women, all four leads, every single episode. And they do it in like 28 minutes, which is a real feat. And I there are shows that I like now, or maybe would like to get more into, who can't seem to achieve the same sort of speed and pace of storytelling. And I think Dairy Girls actually does a really good job of that. There's like a, not just like a speed to the pace. The pace is not just satisfying, but like the actual, like the complexity of the content is satisfying. Like, I just think that they know their characters, they know the story, they know the world. And I think that this episode is just like exemplary of that.
I think if I was a muckety muck up in the executive branches of whatever studio, that I'd be very tempted to say to somebody, your comedy or dramedy or whatever is being greenlit. Please write me 6-hour-long episodes. And when they write them, I come back, this is great. Now make them 30 minutes and you have a show. Because like, as Brittany was saying, like the pace, but it's also like it creates a rhythm. And there is sort of like this wavy action to everything in this episode. And it's very, very compelling. It's very satisfying, you know, from the incredibly boring uncle telling his story, moving into the chip shop scene. Like, it's really just perfect. And I really have to say Netflix's choice of thumbnails for this, like, I thought this was like a coming of age, like, dour dramedy just from all the promotional stuff on Netflix. Yeah. Very piss poor AI job if that's what is happening there. Because this was a revelation. Super funny. I really want to watch the rest of the series now. Sorry to talk out of turn, but just wanted to say like...
No, I was
that
done.
That could be your turn.
Yeah. Okay. It reminded me of The Inbetweeners.
I was going to say that too, yeah.
You know, sort of like the boy version of Dairy Girls, I suppose, set in the modern day instead of mid-90s, I guess.
Yeah.
Yeah. This has better, quicker chemistry, I think, than The Inbetweeners. Like The Inbetweeners, they're always sort of like kind of battling each other. There's a lot of conflict within the group, but sort of like a start and stop sort of conflict, right? Where this one, it just seems to flow kind of like, it's not quite improv, yes and no, but it kind of has, this one feels like it never stops. Mm-hmm. Inbetweeners kind of has this halting kind of gait to it. I was surprised and delighted by this. I think all the leads were fantastic together. When I saw the scene with the giant lollipop pacifier, and I noticed, and it's just like in a half a second of one scene where the hair touches it, I was like, oh, it would be great if they actually followed through on that, because like it really seemed like just a natural thing that happened to the actress. And then they cut back to it 2 seconds later, and she's like picking the hair strands off the pacifier because it's all gooey. I'm like, okay, like this is sort of arrested development attention to detail that I could really get into. It's sort of in betweeners. It also has a Curb Your Enthusiasm sort of energy to it where terrible things compound.
Yes.
But it doesn't become like a complete tragedy at the end of it. Like yeah. they always manage, right. yeah, manage to you know, extract the best humor out of that situation. So yeah, I was very pleasantly surprised by this. I laughed a lot at this, and yeah, I'm in love with all the actors. They're fantastic. Stem to stern.
I'll go next. I think the difference between like a British sensibility in a cringe com, which this isn't quite, but like, you know, where everything goes wrong and you're not necessarily supposed to be rooting for the leads.
Right.
Is that it cuts off, like the end of the episode cuts off when it's still not okay. Like I think in a lot of American right. sitcoms, there has to be that like, and now we're reset for next week. Like this one, it just like, it ends. And having them, as Kimberly said, that the moms are in on the the cover up at the Chippy at Fanula's place is such a great escalation because they've established earlier in the episode, like the Chippy is the heart of the town.
It's the forum.
This is like where all of everyone's social life revolves around. It's very important to not get banned from there because there's a threatened ban earlier in the episode and the mothers are horrified. Like if you can't order there, then we're all fucked on Fridays. What am I supposed to do? Cook?
On the flip side, there is that person that went on the news, somebody they knew,
yes.
and everybody felt so sorry for them that they actually got like free chips for chips a month. And that was like like winning yes. the lottery. Yeah.
Yes. And speaking of the chips, the escalation of like how many bags of chips to order where it starts at 2, and then we cut to the girls in the shop. They're like 7 bags of chips. this going back and forth is great. And Sister Michael, like, such a queen. I love that. The whole clip that we heard is so great. And the fact that, like, her refusing to do the dramatic pause becomes a dramatic pause is, yeah. like, just such smart, weird writing. I had watched the pilot of this before, and it didn't really take. And so I was like, oh, we'll see. And this is, like, miles better than the pilot, in my opinion. And I think we will return to this. What were you going to say, Dave?
On that point, I would say if you somehow skip the pilot and just went to this one, the first 20 seconds of this episode has perfect shorthand about what every character
yep.
in that girl group yeah. is about yes. without saying yes. one word. Yes. All the reactions to that stage song that's being performed at the school at the start of the episode and yep. just their reactions one by one told me where they were within that sort of like click within that sort of teenage, where they lie in that sort of teenage personality type. And yep. I thought that was really well done.
Sarah, take us home.
This is, I have to say, one of the rare, like, accurate depictions of what a friend group is like in a girl's school.
Yep.
Yeah.
I mean, like, TV generally can struggle with showing friend groups sort of like, you know, either everyone's in a fight and it's very WB and dramatic, or everything is a, like, yearbook video and whatever. So that's not... And, you know, you're rearranging the Hollywood sign to be class of 93. Like, that's not, it's like, it's actually all this sort of like in between place and fucking for 12 years sometimes that you've all been together, like evolving this relationship that like a lot of it is just sort of like a B minus people snarling at each other. And this felt lived in. And I was like, oh, yes, this is what this is like. This was definitely something that I wanted to keep watching, which is a key criterion for me. But I also like the little things, like people have mentioned the character like unwinding that hair from her lollipop, but like little things like that, that like they didn't have to nail all this stuff down, but they did, like the ordering with the chips and like the back and forth and the push pull of everybody being like, oh, no, I know the amount of chips that's correct. But particularly the way in which boring Uncle Colm is boring is like completely realized and lived with people who will not be sped up in their storytelling. The exact way that he just sort of doubles back and he's like, oh, that's the taller one. And then the dad's like, no diversions, please. Maybe it was the doesn't matter Colm, and like nothing that you do to speed it up works. What I really loved, except, I mean, Michelle's Jersey of Ireland energy is obviously one of my favorite things in the world now. James realizing that it's mayonnaise. Why is it still sticky? Like, I mean, it's all so good, but like you and I, Tara, were talking in a recent, again with this about the himbo episode of Seinfeld and mm-hmm. the way that plots always like that. You're like, how are they going to pull this all together and make the knot at the end?
Yep.
And the way this episode did that reminded me of Seinfeld in that way that it was like, the whole, like they were sort of up on a rise and they could see the whole field the whole time. And you made an excellent point that it's like, things are still really not okay, but it's like credits. Like,
yeah,
everybody knows here that we're watching a sitcom and it's going to get reset. So like nothing's actively on fire right now. It's fine. I just was extremely impressed and tickled and, wanted to continue to marinate in this world. So excellent pick, excellent show.
All right, before we put the vote, Sarah was talking and reminded me one of the other things I liked about the show is that how they managed to sell you on the fact that all these families have lived in this town for generations and generations without actually having to say it. Like, you know, mm-hmm. everybody knows everybody else and everybody knows about everybody else's great, great, great aunt and what yeah. they did during World War I and why mm-hmm. the Kurd family is ostracized because of it. Like, you're so sold on the ecosystem of this tiny little area. And yep. I think mm-hmm. that says a lot for an episode that's two in for a series.
Yeah.
All right, mm-hmm. let's put this to the vote. Brittany, what say you? Canon worthy or not?
Definitely canon worthy.
Tara.
I agree, yes.
Sarah.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah, that makes 4-4 because I say yes too, so. That means that Dairy Girls, Series 1, Episode 2, you're hereby inducted into the Extra Hot Great Canon.
Americans love a winner.
Yup.
And will not tolerate a loser.
Nope.
It's time for winner and loser of the week. Tara has this week's winner.
I sure do. It's our past and future guest, LaToya Ferguson, the number one Firefly Lane fan in the universe, because Netflix has renewed Firefly Lane for a second season. I made sure to let her know on Twitter. She is justly gloating, and I'm thrilled for her. And now I have a reason to finish season one, finally, because season two is coming, and I gotta know what happens with Tully and Kate.
And loser leak, sir?
Yeah, speaking of Arrested Development references, maybe someone could just get Alec Baldwin a tape recorder and he records himself and then plays it back. Just kidding. It obviously wouldn't do any good. He went on Imperioli and Shirippa's podcast and told this story about how he apparently pitched himself, this is Alec Baldwin, to be the character who killed Tony on The Sopranos and was turned down. We'll link it in the show notes, but the way he tells the story is like, oh my God. And then there's something about like him drying his shirt in the bathroom of a hotel. It's just extremely bizarre.
I have a question. I'm sorry. Did Alec Baldwin pitch him playing somebody who kills Tony Soprano, or did Alec Baldwin yeah. pitch Alec Baldwin, the character, kills Tony Soprano?
Yes.
Okay. Match game.
I mean,
ABC,
in short, Alec Baldwin, stop going on. Get off the internet. Go somewhere else. Be quiet for a long time.
Take your wife with you, please.
You take it to a esposa.
It really just sounds like a first draft pitch on SNL the writers came up with, you know?
Yeah.
I have to listen to that episode because I'm just imagining Imperioli being like, just this pause. It's like, wow. Don't stop believing. I mean, yikes.
Well, speaking about exemplifying things with Alec Baldwin in it, do you know what time it is?
It's game time.
Oh, God.
Game time. Welcome back to Game Time. This is the 8th game in the current season. The scores are Tara with 4. A win today means the season is won by her. Value guest behind with 2, Sarah with 1. Today we're playing 7 days since our last incidental from Tomka, who earns themselves an extra credit topic. Apologies if I butchered your name. This is a tricky one, guys. In this game, I'm going to play you a piece of a sitcom's incidental music.
Ah!
Typically heard between scenes or coming in and out of commercial breaks. Think of the bow, bow, boop, 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 boop from Seinfeld, and you get the idea.
Got it.
Here is an example. Keeping in mind that we're using examples with Mr. Alec Baldwin in it, that show would be, any guesses?
That's 30 Rock.
That's 30 Rock, correct. So I will play you the clip. You have to guess the show.
I'm fucked.
Sometimes you'll get lucky and you'll get pieces of the theme integrated into it. Sometimes you will get lucky with the clips that are cut. You'll get a tiny, tiny little bit of dialogue stuck in there, but not guaranteed.
Okay.
2 points for guessing the show after the clip. Feel free to ask for a replay if you need it. If you're stuck, you can ask for a hint, and I'll give you a letter or two from the show's title, after which the answer is worth 1 point. You only get one guess, Sarah.
Okay, got it.
The hints today work on a sliding scale. If you ask for a hint and you're in third place, I'm going to give you 3 letters. If you're in first place, I'm going to give you 1 letter.
Got it. Works like that. Okay.
If we are at a tie situation, I'll give you the maximum number of hints. So if you're tied at second, I will give you 3 hints.
Okay. Yep.
Let's get the steel meal situation, please, Tara Arianna.
Thank you, Dave. Sarah has 2 steel meals. I have 7 steel meals. Valued guest, Brittany, you have 1 steel meal. So that means if someone else answers wrong and you know the answer, you can jump in real fast and say, steel meal, and then give the correct answer. Yes. But you have to do it before Dave gives the correct answer. Be fast and aggressive. You can do that one time.
Yes.
Okay.
All right. Let's throw it to Pinky to see who will be going first.
We will start with Tara.
All right. Tara, Sarah, Brittany is our order. 24 questions, 1 equalizer zone in the middle of things, plus a tiebreaker if needed. Are we ready to play 7 days since our last incidental?
Yes.
No.
Here yes.
We go. Our first is for Tara.
News radio.
News radio is correct for 2 points. Sarah.
Brady Bunch.
Brady Bunch for 2.
Voice.
First for Brittany. Not to give extra hints, but I'm going to say we're all talking about sitcoms. But of course, remember, sitcoms can have many forms and mediums. So let me play that once again for you.
Okay. I've never seen this show before, but I'm just going to guess it. SpongeBob SquarePants. Is that the show?
Is it? Indeed it is. 2 points.
I've never seen that show. That and Friends. I've never seen it. Yeah. Okay.
That's a nice guessing.
Good guess, and that's how you do it. We're all tied at 2 after 1 question each. Back to Tara.
Yes.
Okay, now don't watch.
Oh, that's Family Guy.
That is Family Guy for 2. To Sarah.
You got it?
Can I hear it again, please?
You sure can.
You got it?
I feel like this is one of those where I guess the one and then it's always the other one. You guys know what I mean. Maybe it's neither. So can I have the hint, please?
Your 2 letters in the title of this show are B-E.
Yeah, I was right. And I would have guessed the other one, but it's Bewitched, right?
Bewitched is good for 1 point. Good use of the hint. Ugh. Here is your 2nd, Brittany.
Oh. Okay. Is it Gilligan's Island?
Is it? Indeed it is. Another 2 points.
Woo! That show I did watch.
You're on fire.
By Sherwood Schwartz.
Tara.
Yes. Roseanne.
Good for two. Back to Sarah D. Bunting.
Can I hear it again, please? Hint.
C-O-S. Gonna need an answer.
Yep. Cousinson. I don't know. I'm gonna be mad, but I don't know.
Get it, Brittany.
The answer is...
Cosby Show.
Good for a steal of 1 point. Well done. Now here is your full question, Brittany.
Okay, I am play it one more time. Damn. I'm between two shows. I'm very certain it's one or the other. Can I get a clue? A hint?
L-I.
Living Single.
Living Single, 1 point. Well done. Great. All right, everybody's question going into the score break. Tara.
Yep. Off the voice, I'm going to guess I Love Lucy.
Good for two.
Wow.
Sarah D. Bunting.
You got me in the eye.
Can I hear it again?
You got me in the eye.
Friends.
Let's hear that one more time and I'll complete that sentence.
You got me in the eye.
See you. That's Scrubs. Scrubs.
Oh, yeah, would never have gotten that.
All right, Brittany, this will take us into our first score break. Here is your incidental music.
Can you play that one more time? This is deep. Wow, I really have no clue. It's hard too, because like, it's really well done. That's a really good cue. A lot of instrumentation. Tells me that it's definitely a really popular major network TV show.
Good stalling. Well done. I see you.
That's what I'm here for.
The first American network started in 1942.
You get two letters if you ask for
a television.
Yeah. Yes, your hint will be worth two letters.
Two letters? I'll take the hint.
This is the hint. I'm not telling you off. F you.
I'm like trying to think of F you. I got nothing. I'm like, I got nothing. Wait.
If you got it, if you're still thinking, we'll give you a couple more seconds. F you.
No, I couldn't.
Got nothing?
No. You just want to say F you again.
Yeah. All right. The show we're looking for there. F-U-L-L House. Full House.
Yeah, that one.
I was like, perfect strangers.
I never was going to get that.
Same songwriters, I think.
All right.
Yeah, I heard that and I was like, somebody paid a lot of money for that cue.
All right, we're halfway through our game, Tara. Let's get the scores.
Okay, very close game. I have 8 points. Brittany has 6 points. Sarah D. Bunting has 3 points.
3 points, Sarah D. Bunting. That means you are in the Gross Worth Ecologer Challenge Zone. As per usual, I have 3 boxes of Trivial Pursuit questions from various eras at the ready. We have the super ancient box, we have the 90s edition box, and we have the pop culture 2 box.
Super ancient box.
Super ancient. All right.
Would like the super ancient box.
Super ancient. 3 points if Good luck. Get three correct. 6 points if you get six correct. Classics. What TV sidekick remarked, other Texas Rangers all dead. You only Ranger left. I'm sorry I had to read it like that.
Oh, boy.
I just pick the cards. I don't look at them first, obviously. All right, who said that?
Tonto.
All right, good for one. Sitcoms. What much-loved sitcom bid goodbye to prime time at 8:30 Eastern on Monday, May 21st, 1990?
Much loved. Gosh. Well, this could be Benson. Benson.
What if it was?
Newhart. Newhart.
Mm. Oh, yeah.
Oh.
That's weird. Okay.
Drama. Drama. What was newspaper photographer Dennis Price's nickname on Lou Grant?
Scoop.
Incorrect. If I told you it was also a Muppet name? Help?
Nope.
Animal. Animal. Three questions left. Kids and Games. What Miss America stalwart emceed the pilot for Hollywood Squares? Miss America stalwart.
Burt Parks.
Larry Hagman is the answer to the next one. I scratched that one. You are correct. Burt Parks. We're going to pull another one for you for stars. You only need...
It's like Larry Hagman. Watch that. Okay.
All right. Okay, this is. I swear this is a different card. What Dallas star touted Zermack shampoo in TV ads? Is that correct? Zermack?
And magazine Zermack. Ads.
It is not. I'm going to give you an additional clue. Larry Hagman. What other Dallas star did that?
That sounds like something Victoria Principal would do.
And yeah, those are years. Your 3 points. Done. Let's update the scores, please, Woo! Tara, after that equalizer challenge.
All right. Big changes. Now Sarah and Brittany are tied with 6. I have 8. Very,
right.
very close game.
That's half the game. Second half coming up. Tara Ariano, you're on deck.
Okay. Futurama.
Futurama, good for 2. Sarah DeBunting.
Bonanza. Can I hear it again, please?
I'm telling you, Mary.
He's telling you, Mary.
Well, I gotta swing big. So, Mary Tyler Moore Show?
Mary Tyler Moore Show. Good for 2. Brittany. Well, we'll play
it
that for
like
you one more time.
Saved by the Bell, but I have, that's my guess. My guess is that.
Ding,
by
ding. Bell. 2 points. Nice. Let's hear the end of that clip, shall we? That 1/4 second of Bell obviously clinched it for you. Back to
I would have guessed Parker Lewis, so well done.
Oh, I used to love that show.
The Designing Women.
That's good for 2. Well done.
Really good.
Sarah.
I mean,
I'm telling you, Sarah, you probably should get this one.
Yeah, no, we're at the point in our rewatch where it's really a lot of yakety sacks between scenes, but I still think this is Cheers.
Woo!
You are correct. Wow. I think that was Norm sighing at the end of that clip. To Brittany.
This is...
Shit. I've been watching this show. Can you play that one more time?
This is...
Now, this is not Saved by the Bell. We've already heard that in case you're going off the bell on that one.
That's a really tricky one. Can I have a, was it hint?
S-O-U. S-O-U.
This is...
Oh.
S-O-U.
Not ringing any bells.
It actually is ringing a bell if you listen carefully.
This is...
Good context clue there.
It's rough because, like, there's a... I can hear a person talking. Mm-hmm. And I feel like I really should know who they are. And I couldn't tell you to save my life.
Throwing in the towel on this one?
I'm throwing in the tile, as Tyrese would say.
All right. Pausing. No steel meals. Anybody want to answer that for shits and giggles?
South Park, I think.
South Park. That was the school bell.
Oh, that's another show I've never seen.
Okay. Back to Tara.
Yep.
All right, boy.
I think that's Kim Cattrall, so I'm going to say Filthy Rich. Just kidding. Sex in the City?
Incorrect. This is a 2-point steel meal situation, if anybody wants to take a stab at it. That is...
All right, boy.
The very recently late Mom.
Oh.
Yeah. Okay. Sarity Bunting.
Hey, kitty.
Once more, please.
Hey, kitty.
Hint.
T-H, and that is not the word the.
Okay. I got thumb improvement. I don't know. Fencing.
Anybody?
I'm out of steel meals.
Okay, what is it?
That 70 Show.
That 70 Show is correct. Yes.
Of course.
All right, Brittany, here is your actual question for real Honest to Goodness points.
Play that one more time.
I sure can. Now, I gave Sarah a clue earlier that this is a show that I know she watches, and I know that you watched this show.
You know that I watched this show? It's the music sounds, it reminds me of like the Banana Stand. I do think it's Arrested Development.
You are correct.
Yay!
Okay.
Yeah. Nice.
All right.
Yay.
Last question for everybody coming so quickly. Tara, let's get the score break, please.
It's so close. Sarah and Brittany are tied with 10 each. I have 12. All so right. It is anybody's game.
Here we go. Tara, here is your last incidental music piece. Name the show. I hear it again.
No, I'm going to guess. Is it Mad About You?
She guessed. This is it. If she guessed right, she wins. If not, opens up the possibility for somebody else. Is it Mad About You? No. The show there is The Nanny.
Oh.
I also would have guessed Mad About You.
I was so sad I didn't have a steel wheel. I recently started rewatching The Nanny again. I was like, yes!
Anybody gets 2 points, they're now tied for first with Tara, but you have to get 2. And this is your last question. So, for Sarah.
Hey.
Once more, please. Is this Friends?
It is Friends. We now have a 2-way tie up top. If Brittany can get this at the 2-point level, we will have it all tied up going into a tiebreaker.
Dun, dun, dun.
So Brittany.
Pressure, no pressure.
No pressure.
No pressure.
No pressure. Here we go. I kind of love our ending with this one, but okay, here we go.
Anybody have room for another?
Really good context clue there. You want to hear it again?
Wait,
just to be safe?
Is this that show? I know who's on the show, and my parents watched the show.
Okay.
No.
And my dad used to buy the shirts that guy used to wear in the show. My dad loved those shirts.
Wait, before you answer.
Everything you're saying sounds like the right show.
Before you answer, I insist I play this for you again.
Okay. Anybody have room for another? Okay, I don't know who that person's voice is.
I don't think it matters.
Okay, it sounds, I'm going to guess that it's 2.5 men.
Yes. We are all tied up at the end of the game.
Good job, everybody.
Wow.
All right. I know it's tied up, but just for the official books, where are we tied exactly, Tarn?
We are all tied up. 12 for me, 12 for Sarah, 12 for Brittany.
All right. Impressive scores. We're going to play the tiebreaker. First person to shout out the answer will win. If you shout out an answer before you can shout again, everybody else has to do an answer. So you get one guess sort of per round, if you were. But you can answer it any time.
Okay.
Incidental music. Here is your clip. Good luck, everybody.
Good luck.
Good luck.
Is it the Addams Family?
It is the Addams Family!
Yay!
Nice! Well done. I thought for sure somebody was going to guess Flintstones on that one.
I was thinking Andy Griffith's show. I was way
I was like, Munsters?
I was like, it's either Munsters or Addams Family.
Well, nice done.
Brittany.
What a game. What a game.
All that Nick at Night paid off.
Valued guest! Valued guest.
Oh boy, that was one for the books. Nicely done. Well, that is it for another episode of Extra Hot Great. We had our tiny cake and ate it too with a look at the summer shovelware that was Crime Scene Kitchen and Small Fortune. Before going around the dial with stops at Legendary, Friends, Married at First Sight, Who Killed Little Gregory But Not Really, and The Bad Batch. Kimberly's canon case for Dairy Girls' second episode was 7 bags worthy. We crowned winner and losers of the week, and Brittany was the winner of this week's Game Time. Woo! Next up, Sweet Tooth on Extra Hot Great, and on the next EEHG, it's Secondary Generation Spinoffs. Remember,
we're listening.
On behalf of Tara Ariano,
don't come crying to me.
Sarah D. Bunting.
Why is it still sticky?
And Brittany Luce.
The Addams Family.
Yeah. Woo! Thanks for listening, everybody. And we'll see you next time right here on Extra Hot Great.
Save it, we fuckers!